This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Hey, Joe.
Hello, Shauna. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited that we're recording again. I've been thinking of books I read during our off period and thinking I kind of want to revisit some of those because I really wanted to talk about them.
I mean, I want to know everything that you read in the period when I wasn't hearing once a week.
We should exchange lists. Yeah.
I don't keep a list.
I do because my memory is so poor. I want to know about what you've been reading.
Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, one of my best friends from England came to stay with me. And I want to shout her out because she has a really amazing radio show, the opera show on NTS. And her name is Hannah Catherine Jones. She's a big genius. And we've been friends since like the first week of university. And she came and talked to my class. And we just talked a lot about books, which is, you know, just so nice with someone that you like check in with maybe like once a year about what we've been like reading and working on. And it's always such a joy. She was here to see a manuscript that's in the Schomburg of Sylvia Winter's Black Metamorphosis, New Natives in a New World. Have you read this book?
No.
It's an extremely influential text in Black studies, broadly conceived, like anybody you could find a use for it. Okay, so she wrote it the late 70s, early 80s. Really, really seminal. One of those books that you feel like, oh, I'm a child of the mind until I read this, and there's all this stuff that it explains, and it's just extremely beautiful writing. I figured maybe I could just read you from the introduction because like it's just extremely cogent and clear.
Yeah.
In this essay, I want to explore a key fact of the Black presence in the Americas. This fact, largely overlooked, is the historical process, the socioeconomic sea change, the cultural metamorphosis by which the multi-tribal African became the, this is underlined, native of that area of experience that we term the New World. The classic example of this transformation is to be found in the plantation islands of the Caribbean. The Caribbean islands constitute the classic plantation area because it is there most nakedly that the plantation system functioned in what we may term its pure state. Increasingly in the 17th century and from then on, the Caribbean islands were, quote, planted with peoples, not in order to form societies, but in order to carry on plantations whose aim was to produce monocrops for a market whose dynamic impulse was that of production for profit. Yet it was to be at the locus of the plantation and in resistance to the dehumanization imposed on him by the market imperative of capitalism that the Black would rehumanize himself as the native of the Caribbean. As native, he was to endure a new form of dehumanization and was to carry on a new variant of the old struggle against exploitation. Essentially, what she goes on to do in this 800-page book is to trace in an extremely expansive way and referencing an extraordinary array of writers this process that people have written about as indigenization. And the idea essentially that of like people brought to America in the Middle Passage, in other violent transformations or in violent transplantations, is what she talks about. There's a conversion of the residents of these places into seeming to be from a new place, and it's just an incredibly rich prompt for her to look at like cultural history and to compare a lot of sources talking about the same phenomenon, which is something I really, really love, and something that she gives herself a lot of space to do, is to say, this person describes the encomienda system like this, this person describes it like this. And she quotes a lot of economic history, which is really, really helpful. So I'm just like being introduced to a whole array of new like Jamaican economists through her references. And it's really exciting and fascinating. And also now I feel I understand my friend's work better.
Amazing. That is fascinating. That's something that I've never thought about.
Right, me neither.
Yeah, that,
well, I suppose I vaguely had taken for granted certain tropes.
Yes.
Right.
Totally. And then the second someone points out their irrationality, I guess, it's sort of like, oh, wow. How did I never occur to me?
Is she, I would say, like, in style, she reminds me a lot of other great kind of world-building writers, like Gayatri Spivak, for example. She has something of a similar certainty to her, although uses a lot of different uses slightly different terminology, like writes about the subaltern and as a perspective historically. And Sylvia Winter writes about the gaze from below, like writing history from below, and she really embodies that in her work and in the way she's putting together sources and putting new perspectives on them. She has like just generally a beautiful, and in her like later work, what I've read already, like a beautiful kind of new and different theory of the human, how human beings conceive of ourselves and how important that is. And it's very like galaxy brain effect. Something that I fairly regularly describe like a book or a movie or something as being, which is like incredibly imprecise, but everyone knows what I mean.
Yeah, it's effective, even if it's not maybe precise. Like, you do get the point across.
Exactly. And it, what also comes across is the fact that I'm like slightly grasping in the wake of these ideas, you know? Like, I think galaxy brain meme implies that you're not like all the way to comprehension yet, because it's a process.
You're right. And it's a really beautiful meme kind of for that reason, that it indicates this progression of thought. And it also sort of reassures you that like these stages of understanding are normal. And I don't know, it's really cool.
That in one's mind you are Vince McMahon. I never know. They're like doing his like opening his eyes really wide because there's like a beautiful woman dancing on the table in front of him.
Yeah. And also, I guess the thrill and the satisfaction that comes with, again, maybe I'm using like a crude term here, but like leveling up your thinking, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The excitement. Like, it's good to feel like a baby of the mind, because then you're like, get to experience the sheer, you know, the pleasure of, the mind expansion. It's a pleasurable process, at least for me.
It is. I agree.
And of course, like with Hannah going to the archive to spend time with the physical unpublished manuscript, like the poetry of that original, and hearing about her experience, like that's such like a beautifully, it's just like been a really beautifully rounded encounter with a piece of writing, if that makes sense, like layered with lots of different stuff, like trying to communicate ideas to somebody else, absorbing ideas, you know, in the kind of like osmotic, is that the adjective?
Yeah.
Osmotic friendship method. It's such a nice thing about being alive and having friends. It's true.
It is.
Expressions of love, you know, like books are a great way, well, they're a great way to love, and it's also amazing because I'm such a huge fan of, again, Hannah Catherine Jones, but Foxy Moron. I'm such a big fan of her work and have been since we were kids, you know, and we've always talked about our work, so I love to kind of trace back from her performances and the imaginary worlds that she creates to these you know, to these primary sources, and to be a to be close to somebody else's practice and the way that like they are almost like annotating in their, they're almost, you know, they're annotating it in your mind with the things that you remember them saying. When was the last time you had that? Maybe it was with you reading. Was it in reading? Wait, which is it? Which of the like biblical writers were you reading and you had like a big epiphany?
Oh, I don't know. I hope I'm having epiphanies constantly. I'm not, but that is something I aspire to. No, I started reading. I was reading Emily Wilson's translation of the Iliad and falling really in love with it. And then I started reading a bunch of other commentary about like ancient Greece, whatever. And then I came to the novels of Mary Renault. Have you read any of hers?
Oh yeah. I always heard it as Renault, but I don't know if that's even,
well, right. I wasn't sure, but some people say she's like the greatest historical novelist of all time. And
yeah,
I've been reading her Alexander trilogy. So first I read Fire from Above, I think, which is when Alexander's like a child into his early adulthood.
Oh, Fire from Heaven.
Fire from Heaven, right? Thank you. Yes. It follows him from, he's like 4 years old or something, to when his father, the king, is murdered and he becomes king. And then I've been reading The Persian Boy, which is the middle, the second one in the trilogy. And it's so good. It's so good. Fire from Heaven, I enjoyed and respected a lot. But The Persian Boy, I think, is just, it is kind of the dream of the historical novel, where something about it feels like so sensuously rich and decadent and so densely detailed, but not in an overwhelming way, just in what seems to be a very accurate way. And I've been thinking about how people will say things like a hot Cheeto would like kill a Victorian child or whatever. This idea that...
Excuse me, sorry. a cheetah, like the cat?
Like a hot Cheeto. Like a... Yeah,
oh, a hot
like,
Cheeto.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like if a Victorian child ate, you know, Lucky Charm cereal, they'd die or something. Like that are...
Yeah.
The fabric of our daily life would be really challenging and blow the mind of someone from the past, which is something I used to think about a lot as a kid. I think it is apocryphal, that story about like people in the theater ran away when the train came toward the camera. I don't think that is real, but it's still a thing people share because it feels like,
yeah,
it could be
the
real.
Kind of like paternalistic, right.
It's like people of the past were so fucking stupid. They aren't sophisticated like we are now. They didn't know anything. They would have seen a train in a picture and screamed or whatever. So the idea that like you drop them into present day and they can't navigate it. But forget that. If you drop me into the past, if you like drop me in the middle of Alexander's trek across India after he picked up the elephants, what? Like I'm faring so well. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, I understand everything I'm seeing right now. This all makes total sense to me. I'm not fazed at all. It's like, no,
yeah.
I feel like the past was so trippy. And
sorry.
I wish I could go back. Like unfathomably strange.
I know. It feels so good for some reason to have the contemporary reality that we live in decentered.
Yes. Yeah.
The origin of complexity and like interiority. Because, like, we all know that, like, every person who's ever lived has had, like, an equally sized universe inside them.
Right.
But yet, we really struggle to feel it.
We've talked before about this idea, this correct theory, I would say, that historical novel is historical fan fiction, essentially. It's fan fiction of the past. And I feel that very strongly in The Persian Boy, because Mary Renault, or Renault, however she pronounced it, however it should be pronounced, she loves Alexander. She worships Alexander. And she does a beautiful job of rendering a man who seems to have almost no flaws and be supernaturally charismatic and intelligent and capable and strong and healthy. And
he's so healthy.
He is so healthy because he keeps getting shot with arrows and then healing. And I really want everyone to read this book and then talk about it with me. I struggle to think of a writer I could compare her to in terms of her, the amount of information and emotion she conveys.
Freaking, like, the main historical novelist.
Who? Oh, Hilary Mantel?
Hilary Mantel, yeah.
I honestly, I've read half of Wolf Hall a long time ago, and that's it. So I don't know.
Ah, okay.
Oh, the narrator of The Persian Boy is this Persian eunuch who is in the historical record as Alexander's consort or romantic partner beyond a doubt. Like, he was 99.9% lovers with his friend Hephaestion. Yeah. Especially, it seems uncontested with Bagoas. I don't know how his name is pronounced, this eunuch. But so she's writing about Alexander and his campaigns, and she has all this familiarity with Macedonian mindset and rituals and, like, norms. But she's also, she's writing in the first person as this Persian who was originally a consort with the king who Alexander, he doesn't kill him, but he basically succeeds him. I wish I could have met her and spoken to her, because I don't understand how she wrote this book. It feels so beyond my capabilities. It just really is shocking to me.
Amazing. It's so interesting. You know, this, the relationship thing, you know, like the gorgeous boyfriend in your army who dies, is like, I guess, kind of like, is it sort of like patterned? It's a bit like Achilles and Patroclus, right? Like, you know how Achilles, when his, like, boyfriend dies, he just, like, goes in his tent, refuses to leave, and is like, no, I can't. There's a
boyfriend, try his freaking soulmate, love of his life. Yes.
A boyfriend, yes, can mean all that. Okay, okay. Military boyfriend does not, sorry, communicate the passion and the intimacy that these men of classical antiquity could achieve while killing stuff together. Well, that's the other strange thing, isn't it? Is that it's the combination of this, like, tenderness and love and grief, and then the this, yeah, like you said, like, long outdoor military slogs. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, but that makes me think that, you know, like, classical antiquity, these texts have so much of interior experience and emotion that's expressed in poetry. So I always just kind of assume that these writers take a lot of inspiration from, you know, like, the texts from which these characters come. My dissertation was about, like, representations of South Asia and the quote-unquote East in European art, you know, like, manuscript illustrations and stories and stuff. So it's sort of like a deep history of Orientalist depiction structures. And so much of it was about Alexander the Great, because this is how a lot of the information that survived into the Middle Ages about, like, India, for example, like, the kind of vector through which the info came was stories about Alexander the Great. He has this very interesting place in what Edward Said would call, like, classical Orientalism, and that includes, you know, like, a sorry word, like, the sexuality of it, It includes like a sense of luxuriousness, of like sexual fluidity as being projected onto, you know, the capital E, East. So I'm curious, what's your take on that in these books? I mean, I don't know what year it was published.
As I said, she worshipped Alexander, but she does describe occasions where he says we're like eradicating this entire tribe, including the women and children. And allegedly, he's kind of famous for being very merciful, uncommonly so, and taking prisoners and letting people surrender and not killing women and children and not really holding grudges as long as he hasn't been like transgressed against in like a treacherous way. But there is a lot of like xenophobia, racism, whatever, you know, all the Macedonians are like, these Persians are like disgusting barbarians. And the Persians, meanwhile, are like, the Macedonians are the most disgusting freaks we've ever laid eyes on. And they don't know how to do anything right. She does, I think, put that perspective forth pretty convincingly. What I was wondering, and I'm curious if you have an opinion about this, I was sort of like, actually, has there ever been a real living person more beloved than Alexander throughout ages, excluding Jesus, excluding Muhammad, like any religious, I don't know, Saint Francis, like if you exclude the religious figures, saints and prophets, is there any guy like Alexander? It just feels like people still, you know, everyone's so obsessed with him. Even me, I kind of have the fever now.
Yeah, so I think he's in that canon of like archetypal leader that includes like King Arthur. Yeah. And this is the thing, and I was trying to make this argument in my dissertation that Arthurian legend was inflected by Alexander legend. Mm-hmm. Wherever there's white people encountering different people. And then I was also looking at crusade narratives and, you know, stagings of in how people like write about encounter between different groups of people. And I would say, I don't know about popularity, honestly. Like, obviously in the medieval texts, they would often have to remember to condemn him for being like a total heathen. but he's like the archetype of somebody who went further than anybody else, right? He represents the triumph of the Western classical world over the Eastern because of his defeat of Darius, and which topples this massive empire. And so I think that the Greeks and the Romans felt like he was the kind of like seat of their authority in some cultural way. And then like medieval people kind of saw themselves as part of that intellectual dynasty. And then all of that becomes part of neoclassical thinking as well as imperialist thinking. He just contains so much and he's so famous. I would say that, he's a huge success and also somebody who dies young. So JFK or Julius Caesar. Can I tell you my favorite story from the medieval Alexander legend, which is based on this amazing text by someone called the pseudo Callisthenes, because everyone thought it was Callisthenes, but it wasn't. But they can't have no better name for him. The story where he meets these people called the Gymnosophists. So Alexander gets all the way to India. And then there's this amazing little story where he meets these people who live in holes underground, and they dress only in leaves, and they're vegetarians, and they live in like peace and harmony with each other. And they are ultimately wise, and they're non-violent, and they refuse to concede to him. And they have these magical trees called the trees of the sun and the moon. And Alexander goes and like prays under them or something, or makes an offering at night, and he has a vision. And under the trees, this is where he hears the prophecy of, you're never going to see your mother again. You're never going to see your home again. This is the end of the line for you. You don't actually get to go any further. And part of the medieval legend is the idea that the world ends somewhere in India, that this is where the earthly paradise is located. There's impassable magical walls somewhere, perhaps. And so for the Europeans, he really represented like the edge of the universe. The known edges, where it kind of stops and then where kind of modern knowledge begins. So he really traces the outline of the world. That makes sense. In medieval maps of the world that have a lot of depictions on them, for example, his characters are there. And he also becomes really bound up with weird Christian legend. Like, supposedly he walled up the tribes of Gog and Magog, and then when the Antichrist returns, they will be unleashed and they will destroy the world. And this is what like crazy fundamentalist Republicans believe. But it's from Alexander the Great. He fuses with everything so that he's almost just like a, yeah, I would say like comparable to a biblical character or a mythological character like Santa.
Right. He seems made up because so many cultures sort of like incorporated myths of him and wanted to claim him as their own. And yeah, in this book, he wants to go kind of to like the end of the world. He wants to go to the sea, the encircling sea. But his army basically won't go with him. That's sort of the beginning of the end for him. That's like a blow to his spirit that he can never recover from, which is that the Macedonians didn't want to keep going, where for him he's like, we're so close, like we just need to keep going, and they're like, no, we're fucking sick of this. it's like typhoon season or whatever, and they're is that what it's called? It's monsoon. It's monsoon season. And they're just like raining nonstop, and he's sort of like, well, when the rain stops, they'll feel better and they'll want to keep going, and they do not feel better, they do not want to keep going. And so that's when that's the point at which he turns back.
I just think it's so interesting that in the medieval legend, what they have is a bunch of pacifist vegetarians telling him, like, stop. You can't go any further. Stop killing people. This is pointless. I love it.
Well, in The Persian Boy, he does pick up a sage, an Indian sage, who starts traveling with him. And the sage essentially says the same. The sage is like, he's grasping a wheel of fire. He just has to let go of the wheel, and he doesn't want to do that. And the wheel is like his ambition. Do you want to hear a paragraph? You want to hear Battleus's voice? Okay. I know the envious Greeks have written that I flattered him, him being Alexander. They lie. Nothing was too good for him or half good enough. I felt the impatience of his greatness reined and curbed by the dullness of lesser men. They say I took his gifts. Of course I did. The best of them was to see his delight in giving. I took them in love, not, like some who claim to be his friends, in covetousness soured with envy. If he had been a hunted man with a king's price on his head, I would have gone barefoot with him through Asia, starved with him, lain down in the market stews to buy him bread. All that is as true as the face of God. So had I no right to make him happy in his victories, there was never a word that did not come from my heart. But it's like the whole book is like that. You know what I mean? It's so intense. I'm like ready to cry. I didn't even like flag that as being an especially emotional paragraph.
I'm excited to read these books. I know that Mary Renner wrote like a bajillion, so I'm pretty excited. I mean, I think I have a lot of baggage almost around this topic. So I thrill to hearing your sort of like, about your new crush on Alexander the Great, because it's a really classic crush to have.
Yeah, it does feel like it's delayed. I should have had this phase earlier in my life, but it's here now, and that's the important thing.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. As seasons change and days grow darker sooner, it can be a tough time for many. That's why it's important to stay connected. It's time to reach out and check in with those you care about, and to remind ourselves that we're not alone. This November, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to check in on friends, reconnect with loved ones, and let them know that you're there. Just as it can take a little courage to send that message or grab coffee with someone you haven't seen in a while, reaching out for therapy can feel difficult too, but it's worth it. And it almost always leaves people wondering, why didn't I do this sooner? With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/thenation. That's BetterHelp.com/thenation.
Joining joining us today is Lauren Michelle Jackson, an assistant professor of English at Northwestern University and a contributing writer at The New Yorker. She is the author of White Negroes and the forthcoming essay collection, Back. Does that have a date
for reading? It does have a date now, which is next year, actually, which feels really soon, but I'm also so ready for it to be away from me and out to other people.
I can't tell you how little I look forward to most essay collections and how much I look forward to this.
I'm dying to know what book you came to talk about, and I feel really bad because I feel like when I invited you on the podcast, I didn't like give my usual spiel to like prepare you even for what it is.
So, well, I just like agreed, like, you know, not sight unseen, but I guess, you know, premise unheard. So, well, okay. So this is like window into my indecisive mind. I had like three, which I don't know if I can like push it off to you two to decide or if I should just choose
you
one of them.
You can try.
Okay.
Yeah, give it a go. Yeah. See what happens.
Okay, so and this is like in no particular order. Mm-hmm. The first thing I thought about was Percival Everett's Glyph from 1999, I want to say. No, maybe earlier than that. 99. Which is a novel about a like genius baby who is like endowed with the powers of language, but he does not speak, prefers not to speak, thinks like speech, he's like so over it. He's like, what is the point? The written word is like the privileged side of meaning. So like, and it's just like very experimental, kind of like theory laden book that is also strewn through with like a heist because he like gets kidnapped and, you know, and by like the government and by like scientists who are all trying to kind of like instrumentalize his like intellect. So there's that. And then also he's like, the baby is Black, and we don't learn that until 50 pages in as this interesting kind of like footnote that feels very Everett in the sense of both like not trying to influence your reading of this character, but also trying to like toy with the notion of how your reading will be changed after he like delivers this information. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my other pick was a book that I literally just finished, which is like Fish Tales by Nettie Jones, which is like so good. My take, or my headlining take on it, is that it's like more gonzo than Fear and Loathing, which I didn't really think was really possible. And then the last one I thought to pick, which is a book that I feel like I never see anyone talk about. And I actually brought it up to her once when I was, we were like doing a university event. And she looked a little bit chagrined, like, I don't know, maybe she wants us to forget that she wrote it, but I fucking love it, which is Symptomatic by Danzy Senna, which is like about this unnamed narrator who moved to New York for a magazine job and befriends this like older coworker. And they're both biracial, but they're both like generationally distinct. And so this like kind of lends like a different relationship to their own kind of like racial identification. And so the older coworker starts to be, you know, it's just like very attached to a kind of like, would she be like Gen X? I'm trying to think. But like she was kind of like the first like generation after loving, basically, a child of the loving generation, right? In this way that makes her very attached to the idea of multiraciality as a superiority or whatever. But it also just starts to become very almost like single white female, like stalkerish. It goes like to a very weird place. The narrator begins like sort of hallucinating and like disappearing. And it's like, it's a very strange, but I think it falls into the genre that I think Senna is very good at, which is crazy Black woman in the best way possible. And so, yeah, that's the slate we got.
It's really strong.
Wow, like, that's incredible.
I don't know how to narrow it down.
Choices. But the Nettie Jones, I'm so fascinated by. That would be my pick, I think. Charlotte, what do you think?
You pick Nettie? I might pick Glick, but I don't know.
Oh, this is so hard.
It's really hard.
We can get Everett out the way, maybe. Like, I feel like he's really in his big, you know, like last year was so huge. I personally love Dr. No, the book that he published sometime before James, which was his book that won so many prizes.
I love that one too.
Yeah, it's so good. And I feel like, I don't know, I just love it when a novelist is flourishing.
I know, he's like really in his famous era, but like the thing I love about Glyph is that it is so, I feel like it is very Everett and hit like kind of filtered Everett and his fascination with Wittgenstein and like language games and like theory and philosophy and just really, and also like kind of like mystery and detective and just weird plots and silly people, which are like always a part of his novels.
Now you're talking about it, like that book is really accessible in a way that not a lot of his novels are. You know, like it's very generous and like rollicking and sweeps you along. But it's not your favorite,
it
sounds like.
It is not my favorite. I feel like I have an appreciation for, I mean, he's like always been like pretty open about his fascination with Twain, or at least like in thinking Twain is like one of the funniest writers at least America has come up with. And so I think this was like the kind of like culmination of that, but I'm always just like interested in, so like in the moments of James where Jim is like having these like philosophical reveries and conversations, that's the stuff that I think is like so fun. But there's a way in which that has to kind of like submit to like following the beats of this plot that like Twain has set up and like finding ways in between them. But they're still like very Everettian like absurdity where, you know, you have a character who is like passing for white wearing blackface in the way that like the blackface actually like enables his like racial like performance in minstrelsy and is kind of like very crucial to him being able to pass, which is just like funny. And hilarious and very, you know, the burlesque of it all, I think, is really fun.
Well, actually, I think burlesque sounds like the perfect pivot to the Gonzo.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think what, like, if to not like make too thin of a like connection between these two, I think these are like both novels, Fishtails and Glyph are both novels that are like very fragmentary. Part of what I think makes Fishtails like such a, I just like tore through it, is like it has these like really short chapters, and for half of the book they're basically organized by the main characters like lovers named after these people that have these sort of like androgynous names like Smoke and Woody. It's like you know, there's men, there's women, you know, the sex is like not, I mean, the main character's like constantly having sex all the time, is,
oh yeah,
doing drugs, drinking. It's set in Detroit, or mostly set in Detroit, and then there's a period where it's like in New York, and it's like, you know, this woman is like deeply unwell, or like the way she's living is absolutely like killing her, but it is just like, what like a riot to read, and like all of these characters who are like, you know, assembling a living somehow, you know, like they just, you know, a chapter will end sort of unceremoniously and then the next one will begin, and you know, the people, the characters like are still there, they're still, nevertheless they persist and you don't know how. There's sex workers, you know, she herself is like able to sustain because she basically off of her like ex-husband. Is it ex-husband? I actually don't know if they like formally divorce. Like she's married to someone and they like have a kind of like continued relationship and like sometimes sleep together and sometimes don't. But like he has his own new woman named Cookie. I realize like I myself am being very gonzo in describing what the hell this novel is. but that is like kind of how it felt to read it, where uh-huh. You are truly just like thrown like right in this way that is very, I think it was, I want to say it was written in the 70s. I should have done my research a little bit better. Because it was, I think, one of the last books that, 1983, but I think it was one of the last books Toni Morrison edited at Random House.
Oh, yes. Wow, I had no idea.
Yes, should have led with that. Though I think she and...
no, that's an amazing twist.
Yeah, no. But it's like, the thing is, like, it's not a Morrisonian novel, like, at all whatsoever. Like, it almost reminds me of, I don't know, like, something like Eve Babbitt's, like, the way the language is just, like, very, it's just, like, so loud. It's so crass, and really blunt. So the second half of the novel, is mostly, like, taken up by her relationship with a, man who is a quadriplegic named Brooke, and their relationship is very, it's very fraught. It's like very codependent. She is obsessed with him. He is like, has a kind of like network of caregivers that he is kind of like, and he's like very good looking, and like a little bit manipulative, but I think also that is what like our like protagonist kind of like likes about it. But like, it, you know, she is like explaining in detail like what this like caretaking role, like down to the like genital cleansing and washing and changing his like urinal and things like that, in this way that just slides in seamlessly with all the like reckless drinking and passing out and lush dinners and setting the house on fire and feeling suicide. It has like everything.
Wow. The idea of having a rotating cast of caregivers that you like dole out emotional connection with is really fascinating. That's such a great premise.
It's funny because he keeps calling them his friends. He's like, I have friends besides you. In this way that, right, again, just really just turns the kind of like psychosexual dynamic of like their relationship into this like very generic category that I think she's like, because she keeps insisting, she's like, I'm your woman. And he's like, you're my friend. You know,
it's making me think, I haven't read Fish Tales, but I have two of my closest friends read it and loved it. And we're saying much the same you are, which is that like it's so funny, it's so fast paced, it's so sort of wild feeling. And I think of that type of exhilaration as belonging to like the female dirtbag narrator who is Joe. Maybe Hothead Paisan sort of falls into this territory.
Yes.
Like Michelle Lisa Carver, I don't know if either of you have read, but like early Lisa Carver stuff. And then maybe also After Claude is sort of one of those entries. It's been a while since I read After Claude. But I have this theory about how like sluts make the best narrators. And
because they get around. Yeah.
And that there's normally, I think there is like this freewheeling quality normally to their prose, because in their lives too, they've rejected propriety, you know, and then there are all these other marginalizations they can fall into, like they're gay or they're sex workers or they're trans. But it's like my favorite type of narrator.
For me, it just feels like such a nice antidote to like a certain kind of like quote unquote messy narrator that is maybe somewhat like in vogue today. But it's the like, oh, I'm such a mess, but I still look amazing. When it's like, as I'm reading this book, I was like, no, this woman is, like I said, like she is unwell. She is like crazy. And I use that with all the loadedness that like that term like,
right,
denotes.
Right.
Like she is truly like cracking open like champagne bottles and like threatening to cut people, actually doing violence, like blacking out and waking up like in the mental hospital. I was like, oh, okay, this is like a real one.
It's like an unneurotic, mad young hottie.
Exactly.
Actually, I don't know her age.
Well, okay, that is like a great question, because I don't really know if like we get, because like, so what is actually really interesting too is that, you know, and part of what I think makes this a, you know, it's the kind of narrator who is like actually not, what do I say, recuperable. Like the, she's not like bad bitch goals, not to like evoke Taylor Swift Life of a Showgirl, but like, you know, it literally starts with her like recounting her first, I'll say, lover, even though she's like, I believe she's like 12 years old, like having sex with this older man. One of her lovers, like across in the early pages, is like a teacher she had that was like, you know, I essentially like assaulting other students. But it's like it all becomes like enfolded into this like tapestry of her like sexual escapades in this way that is very like frank about what is going on. Like it's not romanticizing it at all, and yet it's also not sensationalizing it in this way that is, and that's why I almost say it's like very Morrisonian, in the sense that if you think of The Bluest Eye, which like I guess predates this by maybe a decade, you know, when rape happens in that novel, it is kind of like the organizing thing. It is the thing evoked at the very beginning, and that we actually find out the kind of contours of at the end with Pekala in this like completely devastating way. This is like very much not that. I think I should also say that I think the narrator is white. And I say I think because like race works so strangely in this novel. I really thought she was black the whole time, even though like I think one of her lovers like keeps referring to her like her blue eyes or something like that. But I don't know, or light eyes or something. But I was just like, I don't know, black people can have light eyes or whatever. It's just like I think I was doing a cross between making presumptions based on the race of the author and also just it's Detroit in like the 70s, and like all of her lovers are very like racially diverse in complexion. The way she uses the language she uses to describe them is like very racially libidinal and like interesting ways. And maybe I just kind of wanted her to be black, and maybe she like still can be, who's to say. But it wasn't until I was like, Namwali Sirpal wrote like this great like piece about Fishtails in New York Review of Books, and I was literally like bopping along reading that, and it was that, I think it was like reading that review that I was like, oh, okay, she's white, okay, cool.
I am so arrested by Lauren, what you said about this scene where she's being assaulted by a teacher. Just thinking about this type of narrative where the momentum of it and kind of like maybe like an absence of telling us how we're supposed to feel about different things. I recently read this book called Street Zens about this gay man in California who he started this hospice for men who are dying of AIDS, and he tells this story about getting arrested. And as part of his arrest, once he's taken to the jail, he like has sex with the booking officer and then two more cops. And I'm reading it sort of like, wait, were you raped or were you into this? Like, because he kind of sounds like,
yeah, I definitely, it comes up in Times Square Red, Times Square Blue. I feel like a lot of the, you know, like, well, this is the story of my life, and it's also the story of me fucking and getting fucked, you know, and like some of it's me running away and me running towards. But I guess what about like Delaney that's so incredible is the force of his desire, right? Like the libidinal, it's like so strong that it also swallows up his memories as well.
Yeah, and there's like something about like Delaney's narration that is like, it's like almost matter of fact, maybe, and it's like anthropology. Like I just remember this moment where he's like, he talks about like becoming reacquainted with like someone he had sex with at one of the movie houses, and he's like, oh, like you must be whatever, like 20 something now or 32. And the man's like, no, I was like 14 or 15 when we were like having sex. So I'm like 20, you know what I mean? And it's just, and it's just like, I, you know, it's just like, that is like kind of like a moment or like an interlude or a recounting. And then we kind of just like move on. There's no like extended rumination or like Delaney's like thinking about like the ethics. It's just kind of like, hey, that's how it was. It was like, we were, you know, sitting there kind of like in the dark with a big screen and you don't know who's going to walk through the door. And it could be a 16-year-old. It could be a 6-year-old. Like it's just like kind of the space, and he's not going to really moralize it in that way. And I think that is, I mean, obviously that's like more of memoir, but I think like something in fiction and like a novel, what it enables us to do is like almost lose, maybe not, but like maybe lose some like baggage around like the categorization of different kinds of sex in this way that like can become so loaded and so juridical when we're talking about sort of like quote unquote real people and real events. Whereas I think ideally in the space of fiction, in the space of a novel, we should be able to kind of like think about what is, what can be kind of like uncomfortably ambiguous about a word like consent, right? Which like, again, is like, it is like a juridical term. It's not like a natural, like inborn term of like societies. We like kind of had to create this and invent this for ourselves to like figure out what is permissive and what is not. And there's a lot of reasons why, you know, in reality, to kind of like emphasize it as like a real barrier, but I do think fiction like allows us to think about, you know, even, you know, in the most like kind of like anodyne example, like a bodice ripper or something like that, where it's like, while we don't, you know, we like sometimes that like the, you know, the heroine like doesn't have to exactly ask for what she wants, and it just like is something that is like taken from her or given to her. And she's not,
and giving credit for charisma is something like I feel like in real life, charisma is something really difficult to quantify and explain. People's desires and how other people respond to them exist in this very, very, very complicated and difficult to measure place. And the novel is one of the few places where you can really get deep into figuring out why and how that works, which is also why I'm really curious about your like non-Morrisonian thoughts about it, because to me, like, Toni Morrison's definitely always thinking, you're right, like thinking about her consequences or like outcomes across time, but at the same time is so interested, I think, in feeling the real like sense of a person. And it sounds like there's some of that in Fish Tales.
It's not as ruminative by even half, which is like, it like feels bad to say, but I'm like, this is not like a critique of the novel at all, but it's just, and this goes back to the gonzo nature of it all, where like it does feel like these are like figures who are just ping-ponging off of each other and just like seeing how the like physics like works out, right? We're not, I mean, like nobody is like pausing to take a breath at all. Like you might, and like maybe we presume that like that kind of like the kind of like more static moments in life are happening, you know, sort of in between chapters or something like that, but you know, that in that like kind of like blank sort of like narrative absence, but like it is just, it is like a, she's like a kind of like a perpetual like motion machine, really. And it's like very, it's very sensual, but it's sensual in the kind of like literal sense of we're like smelling things and they're not always good smells and people are sweaty and it's, you know, group sex is happening. And sometimes you're like, I am like losing track of whose genitals are in who, like belong to whom, are in whom, and who's straight, who's not, who's gay, like who's what, like whatever. There's this character Kitty that is, I'm not even like sure how to like identify them, and like at times it's almost like being a man is like their drag, but then, you know, they really like to kind of like play femme with like straight men, but like also men who are maybe not so straight and like to be kind of like coerced out of their straightness in this way that's like really interesting to watch, but also that like I think the narrator a little bit resents, because they're like, come on, like can I have a guy, you know, that's like mine, you know, but like fine, we'll do this like group thing. It's like such a free-for-all, but at the same time it's like the narrator like actually has preferences and tastes and things they want to happen and things they don't want to happen, and also just like at times gets way too fucked up to like have any control over like the scene around them whatsoever, in this way that really like teeters between, oh my god, it sounds so glamorous to be like Detroit in the 70s and like we're going out and we're wearing fur and we're not wearing underwear and we're like sitting at the table, and then, you know, you blink and again, like we're in the mental hospital.
Right, yeah. Right. We're throwing up the next day.
Yeah.
I mean,
she literally wakes up like in a pile of her own vomit.
I knew it.
Because it's like the party is eventually over. Like, I agree, of course. So you're reading all these scenes and it's like, I want to be like high and getting railed all the time. Why aren't I living like this?
Now I'm getting what you're saying, Lauren. I think that it's somebody who lives in the moment for the moment, who nonetheless has to experience time. And so the novel is like almost like forcing them through time in a way that sometimes is like cruel. Because it's like, man, this person really wasn't meant for sequential. Sequential days.
right. But yeah, and I also just want to emphasize, I mean, the writing is just so, like, it's so good. It's so crisp. I just really, really enjoyed reading it and, like, being with this person in this way that, like, obviously, I don't want to undermine the, like, severity of the crazy shit that happens. But it's, again, it's, like, it's not really a novel that, like, encourages a certain kind of moralizing or even like sentimentality. I think it's like deeply allergic to sentimentality. Everyone should read it. It's amazing.
Writers is hosted and produced by Joe Livingstone and Charlotte Shane, and released in partnership with Book Forum Magazine. You can learn more about us and support the show at www.patreon.com/readingwriters. You can also write to us at readingwriterspod@gmail.com with questions, comments, and praise, or leave a review for us wherever you listen.
And thanks also to Marty Solkow and Joe Valley, who composed the beautiful music you're listening to now.
You won't find a better deal on science-backed pregnancy supplements than at Ritual's Black Friday sale. Get what you really deserve, like a prenatal you can trust. Made with bioavailable key nutrients, it even earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. Save 40% on your first month at ritual.com/pregnancy support. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.